You're with Mike Ryan on today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Who would want to be a prime minister right now? Who would want to be a minister right now? We, after the Conservative government, which weren't very conservative, by the way, the Labor Light, many called him, departed the scene. ScoMo, where the bloody hell are you? Probably hiding at the moment. Probably a good idea too, to let the people calm down a bit. But I'm just looking at this, just going through some of the newspapers and online news organisations and their headlines, and it says some very scary things about Australia. And what do you do? I mean, for example, the housing industry is about to get smashed. The cost of building a house skyrocketed by a record almost $77,000 in April, as supply chain and labour shortages continue to bite, with alarm bells sounding more construction firms will collapse in the coming months amid soaring prices, making fixed price contracts unprofitable. How many do you think? I mean, it must be hundreds of thousands of people who have a fixed price contract. And if you've got a fixed price contract, you'd have to be wondering whether your house will be fixed, because they ain't got the money. If your house has gone up $77,000, that's most likely the profit they're going to make from that house. So what will happen is, someone said there was a housing boom, but no profit. So as I said at the start, who would want to be a prime minister? What do you do? Do you bail out the housing industry, private industry, you know, give them a leg up, help them, you know, because of government-induced pain, and which you'll be attacked for doing, or do you let it just all collapse? Because, you know, I don't believe that the government should help. But if someone doesn't help, and if the price has gone up by, you know, $80,000 at least on an average house, you're cactus, aren't you? You're not going to be able to get your house finished. Company won't be there. You're going to have a country full of misery and families. Now look at the rental situation. Okay, so if they're renting, they'll keep renting. There's less houses. The rental situation throughout Australia is appalling again. I mean, you got people on the Gold Coast, the epicenter of the earth. It all happens here. But there are caravan parks full of locals who can't move because they have a gig or a job here. They can't move anywhere else, but they have to live somewhere. Now, they can't rent because a house that should cost $350 or $450 is $1,000. And people are paying 6 months to 12 months in advance. Yeah, $52,000 I'll be paying just to get hold of that house. And that rules out most people, because most people are renting because they really can't buy a house, or don't want to, but they, you know, just can't get that house. And now they can't anyway, because there are no houses available. So think about it. We're just about ready to go down the gurgler. And also, you know, for example, another one here, an extreme shortage of copper over the coming decade could drive the price of the crucial commodity up as high as $140,000 per ton as supplies effectively run out, one expert has ruled. And that will put that's because of the green technologies, but also it will impact green technology. So, I mean, if you're sitting back at the moment in a house and you think, I'm going to sell my property and make some money, you just got to wonder, though, where are you going to live?
Abroad or at home, this is your news.
By staying silent, we are part of the problem.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Much has been written about the Ukraine-Russia conflict, but there's very little hard analysis about why the West, led by the Biden administration, has been so keen to see conflict. And even less has been written about the long-term implications. Mainstream media has promoted a barrage of anti-Russian propaganda. Oh, those Putin lovers. Yeah. Sometimes the truth is a little bit too hard to bear. And let me tell you, mainstream media is not in the habit of telling the truth. Now, as a result of this, the public knows little about the conflict or even who is winning the war. But, you know, out of the Ukraine and you know, and the West and Russia. Let me tell you, Russia is not losing the war. But, I'll let you work that part out yourselves. Regardless, there will be severe repercussions. Now, my guest is Gregory Copley, AM. Now, Greg is the president of the International Strategic Studies Association and founder and editor-in-chief of Defence and Foreign Affairs Group of Publications. He's also the director of intelligence at the Global Information System and Online Encrypted Access Global Intelligence Service, which monitors 290 countries and territories and provides current strategic intelligence solely to governments around the world. Now, Greg's just published the Defence and Foreign Affairs Special Analysis for May 31, 2022, and the subtitle reads, which is really interesting, Cold War II has begun. The global architecture has now changed. That's Cold War II has begun. The global architecture has now changed. What can we expect in the security and strategic realms? First of all, Greg, thanks for joining us again.
Wonderful to be back with you, Mike.
Now, before we get into this, somebody, again, somebody studied geopolitics and all sorts of access to intelligence orgs and said to me once, the Cold War never finished.
It's true. The wars never finish. In fact, we keep thinking that the history is punctuated by periods of war and peace. But in fact, that's not the case. Peace is just the continuation of war by other means. And the Cold War was, if you like, the evolution of World War II after the kinetic operations stopped against the Axis and Japan, and Japanese, the Axis powers, including Germany and Japan and Italy and the like. And it continued between the West and the Soviet Union, not surprisingly, because that war had been going on since literally 1917. And the fact that the war became a Cold War, as we discussed last week, was really out of fear of nuclear escalation. But the reality was that the war became a more pervasive all of society war between particularly, after the Soviet Union collapse, the People's Republic of China and the West, particularly the United States. So that war is going on every day, every minute of every day. We see the continued expansion of the People's Republic of China into the Indo-Pacific, but it relies on its penetration of Europe politically and economically to help make that strategic campaign a reality.
Has the media narrative changed?
Well, the media reflects the technology and the sociology of today's world. The reality is that we stopped seeing classical journalism about 25 years ago as technology overtook the print media. What happened was that when firstly television and particularly television took over, we started to see newspapers becoming and magazines becoming marginalized and particularly from the support of paid subscribers and paid advertisers. So in order for the print media to compete with electronic media, the print media became more of an entertainment medium, more of an opinion medium, and less of a reporting medium, because the electronic reporting with the radio and television and then, of course, subsequently the internet, everybody knew the facts by the time tomorrow's newspaper came out. So basically what the newspapers had to do was to transform into mediums of commentary. And if you had a world which was being moved along emotional lines, particularly by social media, which reflects political correctness, you find that the newspapers do the same thing. And you made the comment earlier in your introduction that the mainstream media never tells the truth. It's not that they don't, quote, tell the truth. It's that they start from a belief position which reflects an unreality, if you like, or a utopian view of the world, or a politically correct view of the world. And the point is, today we see this political correctness has developed into a form of rabid and extreme utopianism. So the truth is nowhere to be found in any of these things. It's all about opinions. And as you say, to people who, when they argue with you, they say, well, I have the right to my opinion. And my response always is, of course you have the right to your opinion, but don't confuse opinions with facts. So if you're looking for the mainstream media to give you facts, they're thin on the ground, because frankly, nobody's interested in facts. They're interested in reinforcing beliefs and passions. And that's, of course, what was galvanized and has been galvanized repeatedly and now increasingly rapidly by the electronic media, and particularly by social media. So arguments are reduced to a few catchphrases. Even in 1920, Lenin said that he could win any argument if he could reduce an argument to a slogan. And that was very, very effective, because slogans are what really trigger public opinion. And subsequently, we've seen that with the visual mediums coming into the play, where in a presidential debate, for example, it's about body language and it's about gestures and so on. So that when you come to the end of a debate between prime ministerial candidates or presidential candidates, people don't remember one word of what they said, but they still come out at the end saying, "Well, I think Joe won as opposed to won the debate as opposed to Bill." The reality is, it's all about an intangible triggering of imagery within the minds of the audiences. And so we've moved even further than relying on the reduction of arguments to slogans, to gestures, colors. There's no mistake that, for example, some of the great revolutions of recent years throughout Eurasia particularly have been called color revolutions, and they've been designed to a showing of colors will trigger a voting pattern or a protest pattern and so on. And in Australia, of course, we saw the teal revolution literally mirroring the color revolutions of Eurasia over the past 10 to 20 years. And not surprisingly, because the sponsor of the color revolutions in Eurasia was a US-based financier, former Hungarian, George Soros. And he did put money into the Get Up movement, which was one of the key financiers of the teal movement in Australia, which basically is deciding the balance of power in the Senate.
Just thinking, some have said that at the moment we have an information operation, which is usually run by intelligence orgs, although there is a company in London that actually runs the information operation in regards to Russia and Ukraine, a bit like Bell Pottinger did with Iraq with this war on terror, and how they produced all these videos, which you just mentioned, that they show imagery to convey that position of the war. And it convinces people that, you know, this is happening and we're doing the right thing. But really, as with Bell Pottinger, they, after $500 million, the people caught on, and Bell Pottinger failed to exist much, much longer after that. I'm just wondering about what's happening at the moment with a information operation. And you mentioned that the media basically isn't all that up to speed, or not up to speed, or that experienced in reporting the actual truth, because that's not what the audience wants. They want to see us winning, but like, you know, the cavalry go riding in. But just the information provided, if it's an information operation run by various governments via outsourced companies, is that a possibility that the information that they're feeding to mainstream media is exactly what they want the narrative to be?
Oh, there's no question about that. We saw the Clinton team in the early 1990s wanting a certain outcome in the Balkans, and they worked with the Croatians and the Albanians and the Bosnian Muslims to really do a number at all levels in the Western media, and using what's in the trade called a black, white, and grey propaganda, and black and grey and white psychological operations. And I know that they, going even through conventional public relations firms in London and New York, those players, apart from what the Clinton administration was doing, put in about $2 billion into that campaign, which convinced the world that the Serbs, who were losing their lands and their people, that they were the aggressors. And it's very much an approach where you, the first thing you do is you make sure that the victim is blamed for the crisis, and the victim is always blamed for doing the things that the aggressors are doing. And that's what happened, and that's why the Balkans situation turned out the way it did, with Serbia remaining today as the underdog in public opinion. And it's interesting that the same Clinton administration operatives are now in senior positions they were in senior positions in the Obama administration and now in the Biden administration, and they're using the same playbook to get public opinion whipped up on the Russia-Ukraine issue, and also, you might have noticed it here, but on the issue of unrest in the Horn of Africa, in Ethiopia, where you see the first fairly credibly elected government since 1974 take office, and all of a sudden is being branded as this as the aggressor in a war against a radical Marxist terrorist organization, which has been conducting genocide, literally, and espousing genocide, killing people because of their ethnicity, language, and beliefs. We've been dragged into the wrong. We were dragged into the wrong side of the Balkan situation. We're being dragged into the wrong side on the Ethiopian situation, and also in the Russia-Ukraine situation, because nobody has either access to or interest in discovering what's really going on and looking at the history of the situation. Mm. With regard to Ukraine, the first thing I ask people is, well, first describe Ukraine. What is Ukraine geopolitically, geographically, and historically? And you start to see how nuanced the situation is there and who the players really are. Now, that's not to say that once conflict gets underway, that people on any side behave in a humane and rational way. Certainly, there will be grave tragedies occurring on all sides. But if you look at the origins of, for example, the Ukraine situation, we had the United States State Department heavily involved in the 2014 Maidan Revolution, which was designed to remove the elected president of Ukraine and replace him, because he was from eastern Ukraine, he was from the Donbass, from Donetsk, in fact, and replace him with a Western Ukrainian leader who was more amenable to the West, who wanted to bring Ukraine into NATO and into the European Union. So to do that, you had the so-called Maidan Revolution, which was one of the color revolutions. They overthrew the president and drove him out of the country and put in a new president. Now, part of that process was they had to stop the people in eastern Ukraine voting in the subsequent election, because if you had a fair election of all of the people of Ukraine, then the eastern Russian-speaking peoples would dominate the vote, and you would once again get a pro-Russian president. So as far as the Western Ukrainians were concerned, that was unacceptable. So you had to divide off the country, the east. So even today, whilst President Zelensky says that he wants to have all of Ukraine restored, he means all of Ukraine, including the Donbass, which only was allocated to Ukraine by the Soviets in 1921 from out of the Russian territory, and Crimea, which was Russian and allocated to Ukrainian administration by Khrushchev in the 60s. So he's saying he wants all that back. But does he really? I don't think so. Basically, he doesn't want a democratic resolution to this situation. And the financial backer of President Zelensky is paid for that unofficial combat force in eastern Ukraine, the Azov battalions, some 60,000 people there who actually wear Nazi insignia. And they're supplied by the Ukrainian government with weapons and the like, and then they paint those weapons, including drones and so on, which they use for the warfare against the Donbass people. Mm. They've been painting them with Nazi insignia. So when you had the Russians saying that they want to eliminate the Nazis from power in eastern Ukraine, that's what they mean.
And Russia doesn't want Ukraine. I mean, even before the conflict escalated, Ukraine was a basket case anyway.
Well, it was one of the most corrupt countries in the world. It ranked far lower down the chain of trust than Russia did in terms of corruption levels, and it was heavily into gang warfare and running criminal operations out into Western Europe and into North America. Now, that's not to say all Ukrainians of the many, many different stripes there are of Ukrainians, that they're involved in that. They are as much victims as anybody else. But Ukraine as an entity has been, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, racked with corruption and problems. And whilst the West paid a lot of money to try to buy up and destroy the nuclear weapons, which were in various parts of the former Soviet Empire, the Ukrainians were busy selling off those weapons to countries like Iran. So these are the people we're supporting now from the West. They're the ones that were literally selling nuclear weapons to Iran. And Iran got nuclear weapons starting in 1991 from Kazakhstan initially, then Ukraine, then from North Korea and so on. But before the Iranians developed their own nuclear weapons technology. But the reality is that we're not seeing a lot of clean hands here. Again, there are many honest, hardworking Ukrainians who want to see a viable, independent, and democratic Ukraine. But we're not helping them with what we're doing now. And certainly Zelensky's not, by making sure that there's a war with Russia, which ultimately will leave him and all of Ukraine in a very poor situation economically and sociologically.
I think it's pretty hard, though, for a puppet to do what he wants, and he is just a puppet. It's amazing who owns him, and it's amazing that a comedian became a ruler of a country, a corrupt one at that. We'll come back to you in a second, Greg. Just go to a break. This is TNT Radio.
Patrick Henningsen on TNT Radio.
No one has undermined the confidence of Western mainstream media institutions more than those institutions themselves, with the sheer volume of fake news and hoaxes and other disinformation that they pump out on literally a daily basis. But the difference between their fake news and disinformation, I'm talking about the mainstream media, the other major source of fake news, propaganda, and disinformation is, of course, our governments. The only difference between their fake news and misinformation and those that they're accusing bloggers of, which they don't have any actual examples to cite, just that they don't like the viewpoint, they don't like the vantage point of independent media. And their talking points mirror that of the Russian state. So therefore, they must all be in league with each other. What a ridiculous, childish analysis that is.
Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
What if you were wearing something sexy? What if you were drinking? What if you made the first move? No matter what, sexual assault is never your fault. Support is available 24/7 through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, reminding you it's never your fault.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
The strength of our country hasn't just been won on the battlefield. It's one every day in our communities when we come together in our toughest times. For over 100 years, the American Legion has been strengthening communities across our nation by providing life-saving help and support to our veterans and neighbors during times like we're facing today. We are the American Legion, Veterans Strengthening America. To learn how you can help, visit legion.org.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
My guest is Gregory Copley, AM. He knows all about all. Greg, just back to the information operation stuff and the stuff that we're fed. It's very hard to decipher what is the truth and what is not. I mean, some reports say that Boris Johnson is stopping Zelensky from negotiating with the Russians. We hear that this is all about preserving Ukraine's democracy and, you know, and so on. How does the general public, because if we read, or most of the public listens or reads or watches legacy media, it's very hard to even get through the cracks and see some sort of truth, isn't it?
It's really hard to do that. And it's ironic when you've got Boris Johnson, who is politically the polar opposite of Joe Biden, espousing the same rabidly anti-Russian line. But we have to bear in mind, Boris Johnson has always been rabidly anti-Russian in his approach. And it's that and his climate change politics sort of seems so at odds with his claim and to be a true conservative. Mm. So, and let alone for him to agree with Joe Biden. But we have to look at the British government, and particularly Boris Johnson, as being, if you like, a ring in to this campaign, which was started definitely by the US State Department and under Biden. And you see the connections with the Biden family and the Ukrainian government over the recent years. You see the connection of the Obama administration earlier in supporting the Maidan revolution. State Department players such as Victoria Nuland, who is back in the Biden administration, really spearheading this anti-Russian drive throughout Europe, but particularly in Ukraine. Now, the Biden administration suffered enormous embarrassment when it was clear that Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, was taking large amounts of money, essentially illegally, from the Ukrainian government, and that Joe Biden himself had gone on television and said that he publicly threatened the Ukrainian government that if they didn't remove an obstacle to Hunter Biden's economic position, shall we say, then the US would cut off aid to the Ukrainian government. So the Ukrainian government bowed to that. But what we saw from the beginning of the Biden administration was this intensely anti-Russian rhetoric, because it relied on that to discredit the opponent, Donald Trump, saying that he was, you know, a stooge for the Russians and that the Russians were interfering with US elections and the like, when there was no evidence of that at all. And that has now been absolutely proven and run through US courts of law. On the contrary, it was the People's Republic of China government which was massively injecting itself into the US political discourse during the run-up to the 2020 presidential and congressional elections. But what happened was that the Biden administration relies on Russia being a bad guy, because you always need a bad guy to blame for your problems or for your opponent's success. But then you had the situation where, going through 2021, Joe Biden's popularity was plummeting. He then engaged in that disastrous withdrawal of US forces from Afghanistan in such a way that the US was effectively removed from any influence in the northern tier countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the like, and in Central Asia. And it basically threw the Central Asian states back into the hands of Moscow. And so it was a very counterproductive sort of situation there. Biden's popularity plummeted. dramatically, the worst of any US president, I think. And then to recover from that, he needed, according to his advocates, the former Clinton people, he needed a war to wage so that he could be a wartime president and look heroic. Mm. So he's very happy then to sacrifice as many Ukrainians as were necessary in order to get his ratings up before the midterm elections in November 2022 in the United States. Because what was going to happen, absent some major turn of events, Biden would lose control, and the Democrats would lose control of both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and that the second 2 years of the Biden term would be totally unproductive. So he needed something, and it was determined that he needed a war. So he literally enticed Russia into the attacks on Ukraine. And how he did that was by this constant drumbeat that Russia was about to attack Ukraine. And there was no evidence for it whatsoever. And the Russians were bemused as to why Biden would keep saying that and stressing that. And the State Department was whipping up frenzy, literally, in the media in late 2021 and early this year. And then on January the 25th, Biden makes a statement which at first appeared incoherent. It was as though he accidentally let the cat out of the bag when he said, well, we want Ukraine to be a member of NATO. We want them to fight and to accelerate their fight in the Donbass region to recover the secessionist Donbass states. But on the other hand, if you get into a confrontation with the Russians over this, we, the United States, will not offer you any military support. And everyone waited for a day because it looks like, oops, Biden has let the cat out of the bag that the U.S. will not support Ukraine in the event of a war. On the other hand, the U.S. was determined for Ukraine to become a member of NATO, mm-hmm. the one thing which was the dramatic red line for Russia, because they cannot afford to have NATO forces within 4 minutes missile striking time of Moscow. So Putin thinks, did I hear that right? Did I get a free one-time pass to clean up the situation in Ukraine? We waited for the next day when the State Department was expected to walk that statement back and recant on Biden's indiscretion. But no, the State Department kept finding little ways to reinforce what Biden said. Mm. So basically, the Kremlin knew that Ukraine was going to become a member of NATO, with the unacceptable thing, if everything went ahead, and B, the United States would actually not stop Russia if it knocked that on the head immediately. So Russia had some 290,000 troops which had been conducting annual exercises in the area around Ukraine. And these were not necessarily first-rate troops, but this is something they did every year, mm-hmm. largely to send a signal that Ukraine was important to them. And so they pushed across the border into that attack. And, of course, then the U.S. reacted and dropped, if you like, the disguise and started imposing the massive constraints on Russia through political and economic sanctions. The interesting thing was that the West immediately came up with the rhetoric that this was a total invasion, a full invasion of Ukraine. Now, we saw in World War II, when the Nazis pushed into Ukraine with Operation Barbarossa, they did so with some 3 million troops, and the death toll was massive. Russia didn't go into Ukraine with 3 million troops. It went in with 290,000 troops with the limited objectives of securing the Donbass, securing land around the support areas around the Crimean Peninsula, and in order to do that, put troops in against the western and northern and western cities so that the Kiev would be forced to withdraw some of its troops from the east and make it easier for Russia to recover the Donbass areas. And true to their word, the Russians have gone in, they've basically secured much of the Donbass. There's still some to go. They have not at any stage entered the big Western cities like Kiev. They didn't even attempt to encircle them, which is what you would do if you wanted to isolate them and destroy them. It didn't destroy the communications coming out of the Ukrainian cities. It didn't destroy the rail and road lines leaving in and out of those cities so that people could have free egress and ingress. But it was trying to pull the Ukrainian troops, and particularly the Azov battalions, away from the east. Now, that didn't really work too well, but the reality was that Russia used limited force to get where it was. The casualty levels, we've got about, 15 to 20,000 total casualties so far in this war, nothing like the many millions of the Nazi versus Stalinist forces of World War II. So you've got a limited conflict which has nonetheless whipped up a massive frenzy in the media. Nobody's talking about facts. They're misdescribing Russia's goals and the success or otherwise which the Russians have had in their conflict. You've had the emotions running so high in Western Europe, with everybody saying that Putin must be either mad or sick and dying and this and that, to the point where you've got the Swedes and the Finns saying that they're going to abandon their neutrality and join NATO. Now, when there was a real threat to the West, including Sweden and Finland during the Cold War, neither of those states thought it was necessary to abandon their neutrality to join NATO. Now, when NATO is essentially a moribund and physically dwindling military alliance, they want to join NATO. You know, it just shows the impact of emotionalism on policymaking.
It's very interesting. I mean, we've just run out of time. Always happens. I'll have to pour a glass of red by myself later on. look, if somebody wants to find out more on on your writings and what you do, how would they do that, Greg?
Well, I think they can get some of it from our publications by going onto our open website, because most of our stuff's in a classified arena, but our open website is Strategic Studies, one word, strategicstudies.org. And we also have a LinkedIn page for the International Strategic Studies Association, which we put up some of our declassified or unclassified reports on that. And there's a lot of material on both of those resources. And we have a monthly print journal, which people can subscribe to if they want, and they can get that through our website of strategicstudies.org.
Absolutely fantastic. I just love these conversations and always a pleasure. Greg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is TNT Radio.
We're saved. A speaker at the World Economic Forum in Davos is now talking about developing an individual carbon footprint tracker. What a great way to improve our lives.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Alibaba Group President Michael J. Evans at Davos.
We're developing, through technology, an ability for consumers to measure their own carbon footprint. What does that mean? That's, where are they traveling? How are they traveling? What are they eating? What are they consuming on the platform? So, individual carbon footprint tracker.
If that's the dystopian hell you want to live under in the Great Reset, be my guest. But the idea of global elites, global governments, and corporate America monitoring every purchase to see how big your carbon footprint gets, count me a no. This is bonkers. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
Hi, Gemma Simon here from the Newcastle Jets for RAD. Playing any sport means setting the right example. And it's not just about how players focus and behave when they're on the field. It's also about their actions and behaviours off it. That includes things like drink driving, drug driving, and driver distractions. No one can perform properly if they're under the influence or distracted. So, make sure you make the right decisions when it comes to getting behind the wheel of a car, and you'll definitely earn respect for it.
A message from RAD.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative.
This is Viewpoint.
Anglo-American instigated regime change wars in recent decades have had a tragic outcome. Remember President George W. Bush's threat to Saddam Hussein in November 2002. If he refuses to disarm, then we will lead a coalition of the willing and disarm him. This threat was based on lies concocted under British Prime Minister Tony Blair that Saddam Hussein could unleash weapons of mass destruction in 45 minutes. More than 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of the conflict in their country since the US-led invasion in 2003. The Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs reports that as of 2021, 9.2 million Iraqis are internally displaced or refugees abroad. Regime change wars have left failed states, hotbeds of terrorism, and a refugee crisis not seen since World War II.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNTRadio.live.
The UK hosted the 26th UN Climate Change Conference of the Parties, which is called COP26 in Glasgow, on the 31st of October to the 13th of November 2021. The COP26 summit brought, or the COP26 summit brought parties together to accelerate action towards the goals of the Paris Agreement and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. And which actually was written by Disneyland. I think Walt Disney wrote that because it's all fairy tale stuff. Anyway, COP27 in Glasgow achieved lower hot air and a reduction in verbal garbage. Okay, you may not know much about this, but we've sent one of our roving reporters out there, made him fly to Scotland and eat haggis and drink terrible whiskey. We'll cross now to him.
We all witnessed the world leaders rush to Glasgow for COP26 and sing the climate crisis song. We have since seen the doubling of fuel and electricity prices and food shortages. If renewables are so cheap, why do we need to subsidise them? But in the spirit of progress, the MTG funded a senior vice president, his pals Dougie and Sonny Jim, to do COP27.
Hello! From COP27 here in Glasgow. This year, you can see that the collective IQ has jumped significantly, and at the same time, the emissions of hot air and verbal garbage has been lowered. We even have arrived at some conclusions unanimously on day one. A, there is no climate crisis. B, there is no global warming. And C, after checking 47 ferry ramps around the globe, there is no sea level rises. However, we did unanimously agree that the majority of the media are too lazy and too full of crap to check the facts. So we hope to see you politicians in Glasgow's COP28 next year to discuss other ways that we can frighten the wits out of the local population and keep control of them. Thank you.
And thank you.
Authorised by Matt Carroll, Senior Vice President, MTG.
Okay, now Stuart Ballantyne is a fellow of the Royal Institution of Naval Architects and a wonderful reporter. Now, Stuart holds a Master of Philosophy, Naval Architecture from Strathclyde University, Scotland, and was awarded an honorary doctorate in science from Strathclyde in 2014 for his services to the maritime industry and haggis. Stuart, good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Mike. Haven't seen you for ages. You should have come with me.
I was actually, after looking at that video, when you were wearing a dress.
Yes, that's right. I've got terrible legs.
It was actually a kilt, sorry. That was after hours, the dress bit. Look, about your trip. Now, the investigations of sea level rises. Now, the climate alarmist need to be alarmed at the actual investigation into whether the seas have risen. Explain.
Well, the fact is, usually the IPCC investigations and the IPCC computer modeling And I've checked some of these computer modelings to actual sea levels in some of the Pacific islands, and it's just a load of nonsense. So I keep checking as I go around the globe. I keep checking, and I did again in Scotland 2 weeks ago. And I, you know, nothing's changed. But except the narrative, as you and Greg Copley discussed in the last three quarters of an hour, is, you know, the narrative has been led by all sorts of spurious agendas. It's terrible.
Mm. What about the measures of climate change in Glasgow, checking the weather? How do the Greens do it? How do they? Hang on, I'm just going to do it myself. Hang on, don't go away.
No.
I licked my finger and put it outside. That's not really a good way of doing it, is it?
No, no. Where I grew up in Scotland, we could look out the kitchen window, and if you could see the top of
Ben Lomond.
Beside Loch Lomond, it was going to rain. But if you couldn't see the top of Ben Lomond, it was raining. It was a very accurate prediction system. It was terrific.
Hey, so, how is Scotland, by the way, travelling post-pandemic? Are there any travel restrictions, mask or vaccine mandates? I mean, do they have...
No, there's
nothing.
They've thrown that all out the window, but noticeably, Mike, the fuel prices increased significantly. They're paying the equivalent of $3.40 Australian per litre. So we're doing okay compared to that. The food prices, everything's gone up, and people are feeling the heat. Feeling the heat, but not inside the houses, mind you. If they want to have the heat inside the houses, they've got to pay twice as much for the electricity.
I read somewhere where they had families in London were going to McDonald's, buying a totally unnutritious but quite delicious burger or whatever, and watching the TVs that were in Macca's and keeping warm because they couldn't afford the fuel or the power bill for their warmth.
Oh, yes. No, there's a lot of reports of that, people huddling around coffee shops and, you know, grabbing a cup of coffee when they go in and sitting it and sipping it very slowly over the next 6 hours because they have TVs, there's Wi-Fi. So why wouldn't you?
Look, one of the great sports of Scotland, I mean, there's probably two. One is hammer throwing and the other one is drinking whiskey. Which ones did you partake in?
Well, I just had a couple of fine whiskeys while I was there because I attended a wedding of an old friend of mine who just recently discovered Viagra and decided to get married. And so we went along to his wedding and we were sampling some fine single malts. But the rest of the time I was lecturing at Strathclyde University and speaking with shipbuilders and doing all sorts of wonderful things. But on the way to the airport, I said to the taxi driver, just turn right here and we'll do a little bit of filming. And we produced that little exercise.
Wow.
So the taxi driver, that was his first time as a cameraman.
So the taxi driver was your cameraman?
Absolutely, because he was just holding my iPhone with videos. And so I hastily put that together and thought I'd send it out because really I'd asked all of the taxi drivers, and I regard taxi drivers as the barometer of good social sense, common sense. Mm. And all of the taxis that I used in my 5 days in the UK, I always asked them, I said, what did you think of COP26?
Mm.
And was there any noticeable change or did we conclude anything? All the taxi drivers said, without a shadow of a doubt, it was a load of crap. Mm. So I said, oh, really? It was that good, was it? Oh, fantastic. Yep.
In Australia, if you walk into a 7-Eleven and there's an Indian there buying something, a lot of people mistake that as being the owner of that 7-Eleven store. In your part of the world where you were, say in Scotland, I know in London, the Pakistanis are very prominent as cab drivers. Was yours a Pakistani?
No. Funny, all of the taxi drivers that I had around Glasgow were actually all Glaswegians. Yes, very strange.
If you go
to places like Adelaide, they're all from the Punjab, and even
Sydney. Beg your pardon. thought you'd been.
Yes, no, the Adelaide taxi drivers are mostly from the Punjab. I go down there frequently.
Sorry. Yep.
The Punjab.
Okay, I'm trying to keep this clean. Sorry about that. But I'm just thinking about the people of Scotland. Have they recovered? Has the economy recovered from? Because they went through lockdowns too. I mean, are they sitting better than Australia is?
They're certainly not. And the cost of living is way higher than what we've got here at the moment. And of course, even when I was there, this is summer to them. This was just 2 weeks ago, but the temperature at night was 5 and during the day it was top 11. And so you'd have to have your heaters going flat chat to keep reasonably warm. And the locals, I've got a few cousins and lots of friends there, so they're all saying they're feeling the pinch economically. So, interesting.
Yeah, we have one of our presenters is Rick Munn, and when he gets one of his fellow Irishmen on, I mean, truly, it sounds like a meeting of leprechauns and steroids. We're the only radio station with subtitles. And I could imagine, though, you meeting all your rallies and stuff. I mean, the Australian vernacular or the Australian part of your English language would have disappeared after a while. It would have been like a meeting of the clans, wouldn't it?
Yes, it was, and you're only there 5 minutes and you have to speak like the locals.
How do the locals speak? Give us an example.
Well, I tell you, Michael, it's great to see you. You're not looking too well. Have you been ill? Have a wee whiskey. All the good stuff. But I went to see an auntie. I had an auntie there. She's very, very old. She's so old that when she remembers when the Dead Sea was just sick. So she was 100, over 100 or something, So, and that's from drinking whiskey.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I mean, normally you live to 200. She must have had a really wild life. Look, before we head off, I mean, the election, I mean, a lot of freedom parties thought they would do better here. What's your thoughts on the overall results and that the Greens and Dash Teals are so prominent now? Do you think we've turned the corner and that we're heading down this slippery slope?
Oh, for sure. I think it was very disappointing to know that, Morrison deserved to lose because he was so spineless and weak.
Mm.
Even though I was I'm a former Liberal voter, but I thought that the only person that put the money where the mouth was Clive Palmer, and I put my votes with him. But again, he didn't do all that well. But I think Pauline Hanson, I was hoping she'd do better. Lib Dems, I thought they would do better. Mm. And collectively, but there's a big shift against the two mainstream parties, as you know. But the primary vote, really, and when you look at that primary vote, the coalition was still ahead of Labour. But where has the country gone? The young people, I think, are quite rightly disillusioned and just went, well, let's have a change. Let's go to the Greens and Teals.
Mm.
Oh, amazing.
It shows you there was another consequence of either COVID or the vaccine. It must have affected people's IQ because I look at the Greens and I think, really? I mean, but they won the vote of the women, didn't they?
Yes, they certainly did. But as Greg Copley quite correctly said in your show the other day, people like the certainty of a captive or captivity as opposed to the uncertainty of freedom. And people actually, that's why we saw McGowan and Palaszczuk re-elected, because they were, and people were under control then, and they sort of felt safe under the Stockholm syndrome. It's just amazing, but it shows you actually most people are done, unfortunately.
We've got 2 minutes left. I'm just thinking what can we look forward to, say, the next, I mean, this term of Albanese? Do you see us in as they would say in the classics, in deep shit?
I think we're in a bit of pain. We're going to be in a bit of pain. But this morning's meeting at the MTG, which was the annual general meeting, the good news was that we've only got 1,000 and 74 days before Labour gets thrown out. So it was 1,074 more sleeps
before Labour gets thrown out. That's probably 2,500 glasses of whiskey.
That's right. But they will go. This is our medicine. We get Labour in every three parliaments, and we throw them out. And I've been around long enough to watch their abysmal performances. I was here with Gillard and Rudd, and I thought, oh dear. And they do get chucked out in the end, and Albanese will be chucked out for sure.
I don't know. I think they'll hang around for another term. That's my fear. Look, we're going to have you back in the studio. We'll have to get see if Jen can organise that and talk more about the things we can't talk about on air.
Absolutely. Sounds great. Thanks, Mike.
All the wicked things. Stuart Ballantyne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is TNT Radio. Coming up next at 6 o'clock tonight, we have Jason Q. Citizen. He may tell you about the cyclone that hit his house and ripped out that shed, which went disappearing into outer space. But coming up next, well, it's a surprise for you. We have somebody. This is TNT Radio. Help!